you, Andy. Pleased to see so many folks here for a little bit of nostalgia, and thanks for coming. Get started here. This is what Rob didn't put up any slides here, but anyway, that's what the water lab looked like when I reported for duty on a gray December day back in 1969. Now, I should have photoshopped it to make the sky look like it really does, which is blue most of the time, but that was a gray December day. But in any event, why, it's really a pretty inconspicuous looking place, but a lot of things went on, good things went on inside there. Rob was talking a bit about, you know, how the group worked, but Ray Jackson was my boss, and he was also willing to let me go off and do some of my own stuff as well as participating in the team sports like soil drying experiment. And one of the ideas I had was, well, if you were to put a cover over the crop, you could keep all that water in there, and you could cut the transpiration down to about 90% or so. Well, if you're going to put a cover over the crop, that's a thing called a greenhouse. And if you're going to do that, you might as well make the atmosphere inside as good as it can be. And so I started getting into CO2 enrichment. And I came up with these CO2, splitting these CO2 enriched greenhouses, closed environment things, and was increasing the yields of tomatoes by about 50% or so, but at the same time I was running up the cost by about 50%, so it wasn't something to go selling out to the growers. But in any event, along came the administrators and said, hey, this isn't looking real good. Why don't you guys, you and a few others around here, start looking at what's likely going to be happening to this large increase of CO2 that's going on in the atmosphere everywhere. So the little outside stimulus, why I, along with Sherwood Itso, was interested in climate change, or non-climate change in his case, and CO2 enrichment. And right next door at the Western Cotton Lab were two cotton physiologists named Jack Mooney and Gene Gwynn, and they were both very interested in trying to maximize the yield of cotton and what happens with CO2 there. So the four of us formed an initial team. I threw away the roof, and we started using open-top chambers then for CO2 enrichment. And we did work on cotton here for several years. Paul Penner got interested in these experiments too, and he kind of joined the team. But along with doing this research, we began to realize that even though we're now trying to do things outside, the inside of an open-top chamber still is not quite what you want to have. There's shading going on, especially the air movement is drastically reduced, and so it really still isn't quite what's going on outside. And so there was talk amongst ourselves, along with a few other people, about could we really do something right out in an open field with CO2 enrichment. Now, I bet you there are a lot of folks in here remember Hartwell Allen. He used to come to these meetings a lot. Any of you remember Joe Shin? Probably not. But anyway, he was another student of Ed Lemon's long, long time ago. And the two of them got together and did this feasibility study about FACE. And it was interesting, the two authors came up with basically opposite conclusions from the thing. And Joe Shin was saying, it's never going to work. But Hartwell Allen said, yeah, but it's kind of fuzzy here. It just might work. So with that stimulation, there's some other reasons why we want to do this outside work. And that is that if we're growing it outside, then we're doing the experiment really under totally outside conditions, and therefore it gets something that should be really good for validating plant growth models and so forth in an absolute sense, rather than just relative increases like you do with open top chambers or other chambers. And then if you have some large plots, there's a lot of plant material for a lot of folks to work. Well, there was kind of a nexus of things came together back there, and one is that Jack Mooney identified Mississippi Chemical as a company in Mississippi that was just spewing out CO2 and fertilizer manufacture, and they said they'd be willing to donate it. Hey, that sounds pretty damn good. So those of us that were there, we got together and we started doing writing assignments then to a proposal then for this FACE experiment. And there were engineers from Brookhaven National Laboratory that were also interested in this kind of work for forests and so forth. And we were all there together, and anyway, the upshot of this was that there was Keith Lewin then went over to England and started studying where they were doing free air SO2, pollutant experiments under a free air condition. There you're talking parts per trillion. CO2 is parts per million, so it's a little bit of different scaling going on there. But in any event, there was somewhat of an initial start for this kind of thing. But one of the things that went on was, here's this Roger Dahlman, that's the DOE program manager, and he's done a lot then for CO2 enrichment research. And Rob should have mentioned that one of the legacies that's coming in here is that there's, we had our base funding from ARS, but a stimulation funding from the remote sensors coming from NASA, and in our case from the Department of Energy, really made a lot of difference in being able to do these experiments. Well, I'll move along here. First FACE apparatus was done at Brookhaven National Lab up on Long Island in New York. They moved us to Mississippi. To make a long story short, it turned out that Mississippi was not the place to do it. That factory that had the free CO2 was also generating some brown stuff coming off the factory. I'm sure there was a nitrogen gradient across the field. It was variable anyway. Not a good place for agricultural research. Make a long story short, they decided to bring the CO2 to the scientists rather than the scientists to the CO2. It was not my decision, but they decided the best place to do this was kind of there in Maricopa, where Kimball and Mooney and this other team are already doing the CO2 research in the open top chambers on cotton. So we did that. We did research on cotton, on wheat, and on sorghum. There's a bunch of us out in the field on that, and this is kind of the highlight of the whole thing, was that I found a lot more folks are interested in wheat than in cotton. And when you're the only show in the whole world doing this kind of thing, well, we had something like 50 scientists that came there to the lab and so forth, like 28 different research groups in 8 countries, so that was kind of a pretty exciting time. And this is kind of the legacy from that then. I can give you a whole lecture and spend all my time just talking about this one graph, but we did the work on wheat and on sorghum and on the cotton. But you can see since then, FACE experiments have been done all around the world in all of these different crops, and that's kind of a summary of what's been found then over the intervening years up until a few months ago. This is a sensors group, and I'm running out of time, but in any event, one of the things I did was to measure evapotranspiration then when there's no walls in the tiny plot. Following Ray Jackson, we use the residual energy balance. We keep Apogee in business and Campbell along with them with lots of instruments. We found out that under the free air conditions, evapotranspiration was reduced maybe an average of 7% or so. And so anyway, some 70 papers have been written based on that work that we did there within our face experiments. But, and then there's some 15 models, papers have been written validating models with that work, so that's pretty interesting. And then I started fiddling around with these infrared heaters and putting those out, because we wanted to see what would happen with free air warming, and that's some 21 different groups now around the world that have been using the heaters and that. And then we did our own experiment called the Hot Serial Experiment there at MAC with a team of myself, Jeff White, Gary Wall, Mike Ottman from Mike's from the University of Arizona, and this is down at Maricopa too. And result of that thing was that here's what the high temperature effects are on wheat yields. It looks like it's pretty well dead at about 32 degrees C if you average over the whole season long the wheat yield. Well, that caught the attention of this AgMIP group that had 30 different wheat models that they were testing. And so that paper came out. They looked around the world at what's happening to wheat production here and there across the whole world. And the conclusion was that it looks like worldwide wheat production is going to go down about 6% for every degree increase in temperature. So there's all the different names on the paper that came out rising from that. And so there's my final slide here. It looks like I got a minute to go. And so I want to say that, like Bob was saying, we really had a good esprit de corps at the lab, and that didn't come by accident. That had to do with good leaders like Lloyd Myers that started it off and continued on, and Bob and Ray Jackson and so forth. We were willing to share data amongst yourselves and recruit outside researchers as well, and we're willing to share data, especially for crop growth models and so forth. And so that's kind of how I think we've got a pretty good legacy around the world and so forth. And with that, I'll say that's the end, and thank you for your attention.
We have time for a couple of questions. So what's going on with FACE nowadays?
There's FACE going on, a big one on wheat in Australia. It's called Ag FACE, Australian Grains. China's got a wheat cotton, not wheat cotton, wheat rice rotation going on of that. Japanese have got FACE experiments going on in agricultural crops. And then there's at least one or two going on in Germany still. And then some on natural ecosystems, so those have kind of died down.
Jeff, you have a question?
Well, Chris can probably guess if I'd be reluctant to ask it.
No, don't ask it. We don't have time.
Ben, do you want to comment on the issue of fluctuating levels of CO2 in the phase three?
That's kind of a whole lecture, but in any event, one of the questions that come up is just, we're seeing evidence, particularly work by Jim Bunce, that indicates if you've got fluctuating CO2, the response is not as great as it would be if you had a steady increase. And so out in these space rings, we do have the fluctuating CO2 going on. And if you look at the whole picture, it looks to me like, you know, we're still getting pretty good responses out there. And so I think the response to CO2 is at least as great and probably greater than we have seen in that slide that I showed.
And more research is needed.
More research is greater. Bruce.
Bruce, you alluded in the very beginning how you started in greenhouses and then morphed into green air CO2. And of course, the greenhouse stuff and world changes is going on continuously. Recently, there's a lot of interest in not doing controlled environment CO2 studies going all through phase.
I think that's passed. I think we're headed back. Anyway, I see value in both with the open top chambers and closed chambers. You can expose the plants to a lot bigger range of conditions than we can do outside and really get at more detailed mechanisms, whereas outside, it's more the natural conditions, it's better for validating plant growth models and all that business. So I see both approaches as having value.
I think you would agree. So far, there have been only two experiments that done side by side in comparison.
Yeah.
Of open top, and one of them was your own work, which was sort of under replicated and improvised. But in the world of infinite resources, somebody should do a properly designed face experiment with open top chambers side by side, possibly even different designs of open top chambers.
I've already got a really good design. If we get somebody to fund it for me. I thought the Australians were going to do it, but it hasn't happened.
Let's get some chalk and we'll chalk.